From the Land-Grant University in Urbana-Champaign, Illinois, this is the Closing Market Report. It is the 20th day of August, 2010. I'm Todd Gleason. In a few moments, we'll talk about the commodity markets with Mike Zuzulo of Global Commodity Analytics in Lafayette, Indiana. In agricultural news, a hostile takeover offer has officially been launched on the world's largest fertilizer company. And Potash Corporation, for its part, has decided to take an active part in its sale. And it's looking for other suitors. Dave Dickey will have details of these stories shortly. Also in this half hour, we'll hear a commentary from the Farm Bureau. And then in the second half hour of our program, Dave will return today. He had a discussion yesterday morning with ADM's Steve Freed about the marketplace. You'll hear it all on this whole hour of agricultural programming from Illinois Public Media. It is, of course, a production of the University of Illinois.
This stock and commodity report on Illinois Public Media is made possible with support from Bates Commodities in Normal, providing clients with the latest market information based on research by ADM Investor Services and other independent sources. Bates Commodities can be reached at 1-800-383-4647 or on the internet at batescom.net.
In Chicago, on this Friday afternoon, September wheat settled at $6.79, 2.25 lower. December at 7.12, down 2.25. And next year's July soft red winter wheat finished at 7.06 1/4, a half cent higher. The hard red in Kansas City for the September lead option at 7.05 1/2, up 1/4 for the day. September corn futures at 4.21 1/4, up 7. December at 4.36 1/4, 7 higher. March corn at 4.48 3/4, 7.5 higher. And the May at 4.55 1/4, up 7 3/4. July at 4.61, up 7 3/4. Next year's December, the 2011 contract at $4.42 1/4, up 8.5 cents. September soybeans at $10.09 1/4, down 7.5. November at 10.04, down 8.25. And the January beans at $10.11, 8.25 lower. March futures at 10.15 3/4, down 8.25. And the July at 10.25, down 7 3/4. September bean meal at $300.80, 1.70 lower. September bean oil at $36.52, down 37 cents on the afternoon. August live cattle futures, $99.60, 42.5 cents higher. The October up 7.5 at $99.25. August feeders at $114.60, 55 cents higher. The September feeder cattle, $116.65. They're up a dollar even. And the October lean hog futures today in Chicago from the CME at $77.20 finished the day down 65 cents. You're listening to the Closing Market Report from the University of Illinois. Here's what the outside markets look like at this hour. September crude oil future, $73.46 a barrel, down 97 cents. Ethanol at $1.85 8/10, that's 7/10 of a cent higher. Natural gas at $4.12 4/10, down 4 7/10. The heating oil or diesel fuel at $1.97 4/10 of a cent, down 2 6/10 of a cent. And the gold futures at $1,227.20, the settlement price there, down $6.60 today. The Dow Jones Industrial Average just about 50 points lower at 10,222. And the U.S. dollar at 83.04 is up 0.60 on the afternoon. The CRB index at 267.04 is down 1.1. The Goldman Sachs at 505.21 is down 4.4 on the day. Here's what the weather forecast from Drew Lerner looks like for the afternoon. He says there will be thunderstorms across some of the Midwest later today, through Sunday morning over the weekend. Rainfall amounts between 0.2 inches and 0.75. It's most likely with some local totals of 1.5 inches or more. Eastern Iowa, Illinois, eastern Missouri will possibly receive the greatest rainfall, according to Mr. Lerner. Michigan, northeastern Indiana, and Ohio will receive only a limited amount of rain. Net drying, though, likely most of next week throughout the lower and eastern parts of the Midwest. Some showers and thunderstorms will occur in the northwest. Temperatures should reach in the 80s and the low 90s this weekend. That followed by lows in the 60s and the 70s overnight. Warmer in the western Corn Belt Saturday afternoon and Sunday with extreme highs well into the 90s. A cooling will impact northern half of the Midwest during the early to midweek next week. Highs back in the 70s and lows in the 80s with some 90s in the south. More on the weather later.
Todd Gleason services are made available to WILL by University of Illinois Extension.
Agricultural programs are made possible by First Midwest Bank, serving Illinois' agricultural community with locations in Champaign, Danville, Galesburg, Morris, and Moline. More information is available from Bob Baisdiffer in Danville at 217-477-6016. First Midwest Bank, member FDIC, an equal housing lender.
You're listening to the Closing Market Report. It is a production of Illinois Public Media. It's a Friday afternoon. We're joined, as always, by Mike Zuzalo. He's at Global Analytics and Commodities and Consulting up in Lafayette, Indiana. Good afternoon to you, Mike.
Hey there, Todd. How are you today?
Oh, I'm hopping and raring to go and waiting for Chip Flory to show up by phone and you by the Prius, I suppose, this afternoon for Commodity Week. Should be a fun show as we put that one together around 4:30 this afternoon. I know you got to get on the road, and we'll have fun talking to him, I would think.
Yeah, and it's funny because the numbers came out. It sounds like right on the close, we made some new daily highs in corn, and the beans really didn't react very much, and some of the floor contacts were thinking that maybe the numbers from Pro Farmer, which are now out formally, they were being talked about, or some may have known about a little bit or gotten the flash on it or something like that, and they tried to trade that in the very end of the trading day with a lot of spread activity, buying the corn, selling the beans, it sounds like, from the early reports.
And what are your suggestions that we'll be talking mostly with Chip about this afternoon?
As far as the actual tour, you mean?
Yeah, is the tour, what you think he might have found, and how the Pro Farmer numbers differ from what they found?
Well, I think the big thing I'm going to ask him about, or I'd kind of like to know about, is the satellite imagery and whether that the holes that are out there in the fields, how they compensated for that, or whether they even did compensate for it, or whether they figured, well, by going out to a certain number of rows, we probably hit some holes, we probably hit some good ground, and that's all kind of factored in by the way we did our methodology of getting out on the ground. But I think most of the producers out there, especially when we went to El Paso last night and had the panel meeting up there with you folks, it seemed like the holes from earlier this spring of drowned out areas of both corn and beans, and the holes that even grew but have severe nitrogen losses probably are the biggest question mark I would have on the corn. On the beans, I'm going to probably try and focus more upon the pod counts and what the expectation of the pod counts are being higher versus the sudden death syndrome out there in Iowa and even in Illinois.
What do you make of the marketplace for the week?
Mostly the trading the Pro Farmer Tour, Todd. I think that was a big, big thing. I think that the corn also showed some demand bullishness today, especially and yesterday. It seemed like when we went down and tested near-term support, unlike the beans, the corn market found support, and I think some demand buying. The beans did not, because I think the trade's a little bit less confident that the yields in beans are going to be very disappointing and actually may even go up if we get these weekend rains. But I think these weekend rains are going to be huge for the bean market next week. If we, with the chart damage we did today, and if we take out the very key support of 990, 995 on November beans Sunday night after the rains have either come through or not come through, I think that means a lot. We could be in store for another 45, 50 cents lower, technically speaking. So I think if we miss rains, the Pro Farmer numbers are out. I think we could have a nice shot back up to the upside. If we get the rains, Pro Farmer numbers are out, and we take out that 990, 995 level, it's going to be tough on the technicals.
I suppose we didn't say those Pro Farmer numbers, but they're 164.1 for corn. That's a national average. That down, of course, from the 165 national average from USDA, and they're at 44.9 on their soybean number, and that's an awfully big number.
Yeah, that puts you about 70 million more on carryover, so if you keep everything else the same on supply and demand balance sheet, you're talking about a 420 carryover, and you start talking 420, and the trade starts to buy into that, that's where you start talking about more like $9 than you start talking about $10. The other thing I asked the trade before we went on the air today was, are any of the reports of the early yields coming in the corn? Because some of my clients in Tennessee are harvesting, and yields are all over the place, 90 bushels to 140. So mediocre to poor to really, really good. And I wondered if anything was getting hit in the Board of Trade, as far as early yield reports, nothing being reported or talked about from the contacts I spoke with.
Boy, it seems odd at this point. We've been contra-seasonal or counter-seasonal, however you want to pronounce it, one way or the other. Do we really, maybe we need a break in the marketplace before we head into harvest and to get things evened up and ready to go again?
I think that it would not be bad, technically speaking. I think what we continue to fight are the outside markets and the battle between the United States and Japan and the deflationary pressures that we're starting to see here versus how great the Asian demand is and how great the Asian GDP numbers are, and that world trade is back. You know, the emerging markets are back to pre-crisis levels as of May in terms of world merchandise trade. So right now we've got the demand on our side, but I think it goes back to prices going up too fast and too hard and shocking the demand is not what we want. So a correction going into harvest and getting more seasonal in our price analysis and how the Chicago people and the investor community thinks about the grains, I think it would be nothing but healthy to the trade to have that.
Speaking of demand, have you been watching the corn export numbers? Those were pretty decent yesterday.
Phenomenal yesterday, and we had another huge day today. We had 120,000 more to Egypt. I mean, think about it. Egypt's buying corn from the United States right now, and we had another 212,000 tons of corn sold to unknown destinations this morning. And like I said, the corn demand, I think, is starting to bleed into the trade psychology. But the bean demand so far, I think, is being held back. It's interesting with the beans. We're now back below where we were on the lows of the report day. On August 12th, our low in no beans was 10.11 and a quarter. We're back below that on a closing basis. So that tells me that the trade is not really pricing in any demand right now, any improving demand. They're really focusing on trying to take the yield back up and take that out of the price going into harvest. So, again, there's something next week is going to be a real critical week to start the week on the beans as far as the technicals, because where the technicals lie and the outside markets lie, that's usually where the commodity trading funds lie in the beans, and that's where you build up the momentum to the upside or downside based upon how the technicals and the outside markets are working.
You mentioned that the Asian economies and demand for our crops, those in the United States, were up. Are you satisfied that those economies can maintain the steam that they've built up at this point?
You know, it's interesting. I just got done doing a big piece of analysis on the 97 Asian collapse versus what we're dealing with on our collapse here in financial markets in this past year and a half. And the big difference, Todd, is that the Asian markets are leading us out, whereas back in 97 it was actually the United States and Europe that was leading us out. And because of that mirror image of this trade being better and the emerging markets leading us out, a big factor of why the emerging markets are getting so much investment and getting so much foreign direct investment as well as the internal investment is really because of the bond market and because of the low interest rates that we continue to carry here. The more the Federal Reserve tries to stimulate our domestic economy and keep bond rates low, the more the emerging markets are going to see investor flows. And I think that's the biggest issue that we have to contend with, is if the bonds top, emerging markets are probably topping with them.
We'll see you at 4:30.
All right, I'll get the radar detector on in Indiana only and be over in a little bit.
Okay, thanks much.
Thanks, Mike.
That's Mike Zuzulo. He'll be for Commodity Week this afternoon here. Our program, you can hear that at 6 o'clock at willag.org.
Agricultural programming is made possible by Farm Credit Services of Illinois. Farm Credit Services of Illinois has been providing for farmers' credit and insurance needs for over 90 years, including real estate, operating and machinery loans, crop and life insurance protection, and programs for young and beginning farmers.
Now here's Dave with today's agricultural news.
In agricultural news, miner BHP Billiton formally launched its $39 billion hostile offer for Potash Corporation, the world's largest fertilizer company. Details of the offer were the same as when BHP said on Wednesday it was bypassing the board of Potash Corporation, which had rejected the bid and would go directly to shareholders. BHP reiterated in a statement today it would pay $130 per share for all of Potash Corporation stock, and the offer would close on October 19th. Meanwhile, Potash Corporation's search for buyers willing to top BHP's $39 billion hostile offer could encourage Chinese firms to join the fray. Industry sources say that top Chinese fertilizer company Sinofert, in which Potash owns a 22% stake, is the most logical candidate to lead a counteroffer. While Sinofert itself is small, its $3.8 billion market value is less than a tenth of Potash's. Its parent, Sinochem Group, is a huge state-owned group. Sinochem's revenues were $36 billion last year. President Barack Obama yesterday appointed Dr. Elizabeth Hagen as USDA Undersecretary for Food Safety on a recess basis, rather than wait for the Senate to confirm her. As Undersecretary, Hagen will be in charge of federal food safety policy for meat, poultry, and ag products, and of food safety negotiations with other countries and international organizations. The Undersecretary for Food Safety has been the only sub-cabinet-level position that has been left unfilled since the president took office. NOAA forecasters today say that above normal temperatures are expected in a wide swath of the U.S. from the desert southwest across the central U.S. and into the northeast in September through November. NOAA's forecast shows potential for above normal temperatures to be concentrated in New England, the Great Lakes region, and the deep southwest. NOAA said the forecasts are influenced by La Nina conditions, which developed in July. J.M. Smucker Company says its net income rose 5% in the first quarter as shoppers spent cautiously but purchased basic items such as coffee and peanut butter. The maker of Jif peanut butter said it earned $102.9 million or 86 cents per share for the quarter. That's up from $98.1 million or 83 cents per share earned in the same quarter last year. And that's a look at today's agricultural news.
Hey, thanks, Dave. Dave Dickey is Director of Agricultural Programming for Illinois Public Media. That's public radio for the farming world. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason, the host of the Closing Market Report and Commodity Week. Our guest this week on that program will be Chip Flory, fresh off the Pro Farmer Crop Tour. Be sure to visit our website and listen to the program if you can't hear it on your radio station. The website address is willag.org. We'll post the program by about 6 o'clock this evening. Now up next in today's listener opinion forum, Shelby County Farm Bureau's Amy Rochkus has a code for country living.
Living in the country can be a wonderful way of life, but reality seldom measures up to the romanticized version of any idea or ideal, as is frequently discovered by those who move from the city to the country. People often intend to get away from it all and enjoy the serenity of country life. However, they trade the benefits and drawback of city life to those of country life. In Illinois, you will find working farms. That's right, this is farm country. Agriculture is an integral part of Illinois. If you choose to live in the country, you choose to live among the farms of our rural countryside and the people who own and operate those farms. Illinois has a right to farm legislation that helps to protect established farm operations using good management practices from nuisance and liable suits. Right to farm helps enable farmers to responsibly continue producing food and fiber for the nation and world. Living in the country means you are a part of farm country. Farmers sometimes work around the clock, which often involves the use of large farm machinery and implements. Daytime and nighttime peace and quiet may be disturbed by common agricultural practices during spring planting and fall harvest work seasons. There is nothing better than the sights, smells, and sounds of the country, too. Crop production and protection products are used in Illinois to help us grow our abundant, healthy crops. These products are applied by licensed applicators who take precautions to properly handle and apply them. Animals and their manure can cause objectionable odors. Farmers use best management practices to limit that odor and follow government guidelines during field application to minimize odor impacts. Manure serves as a valuable source of organic fertilizer, and it uses lower dependency on synthetic nutrients. Still, your nose may disagree. Check carefully before buying a rural home site to be sure it is located in a reasonable distance from a livestock operation, and keep in mind those prevailing winds. Rural residents are generally very friendly and open. Neighborliness is practiced and expected in return. Get to know your rural neighbors and wave as you meet them on the road. Settlers on the Illinois prairie lived by a code suited to their own livelihood and lifestyle in the rural countryside. Though that way of life has evolved over the two centuries, there still remains a code, a way of living that rural Illinois residents still honor today. This is Amy Rochkis with the Shelby County Farm Bureau.
Amy Rochkis' comments are her own. They reflect her opinions. They do not necessarily reflect those of this station. We strongly urge listeners like you to become involved by sharing your views as well. To do so, just give us a call. The number is 217-333-9697.
Agricultural programs are made possible by Risk Management Commodities Incorporated in Lafayette, Indiana, Chalmers, Indiana, and Hudsonville, Illinois. Risk Management Commodities focuses on managing risk in today's complex and sophisticated commodities market. 866-837-9027.
Let's catch up now on the latest with Chip Flory from the Crop Tour that's sponsored by Pioneer and put on by Pro Farmer. Of course, Flory will be our guest on this evening's Commodity Week. You can hear it at willag.org. By about 6 o'clock, he's been out on the road, and they were across Minnesota where they found a healthy corn crop in the southern part of the state.
That was a bit of a shock to the group here in Austin. They expected that the yield was going to be a little bit bigger than what we found. We were at 185.46 bushels per acre. That was up 0.08% from last year. So we'll call it a match.
Flory says Minnesota's final corn crop estimate will be adjusted for Pro Farmer's historical error.
You've got to take about 12 bushels per acre off of that. The reason that we do that is because we don't sample the lower corn yielding acres in central and northern Minnesota, and there's a lot of corn acres up there that will eventually pull the number down from that 185.46.
So this year, Flory says he doesn't see the adjustment being a full 12 bushels. Don't forget you can hear Chip Flory and the Pro Farmer massaged estimates for the corn crop and the bean crop on Commodity Week. He'll be our guest. We'll post it to the website by about 6 o'clock this evening at willag.org. In just 2 minutes, stay with us because our own Dave Dickey will talk with Steve Freed at 8 a.m.
Support comes from Stewart Peterson, since 1985 offering strategic commodity consulting and marketing services to help producers manage market opportunities and risks. The firm develops strategies customized to each client's goals and operation size. More information is available at www.stewart-peterson.com.
The Closing Market Report is a production of Illinois Public Media. You can find all of our agricultural programming online at willag.org. That's willag.org. From our pre-opening market report to our closing market report on a daily basis, plus Commodity Week, it's all there for free at willag.org. And don't forget to sign up for our weekend newsletter.
Support for the Closing Market Report comes from AgriGold Hybrids, featuring the AgriGold Giants, a group of 5 new hybrids designed to meet the performance standards of yield, health, and consistency required by Midwestern corn growers. More information is at AgriGoldGiants.com or at 800-262-7333.
This is Illinois Public Media Director of Agricultural Programming, Dave Dickey. In business news, President Barack Obama has asked U.S. Trade Representative Ron Kirk to resolve contentious trade issues with South Korea involving beef and automobiles before the president meets in November with G20 heads of state in Seoul, South Korea. At issue is the bilateral free trade agreement between the U.S. and South Korea that was negotiated by the George W. Bush administration, but not yet submitted to Congress for its approval because the FTA likely would not pass in its current form. An Israeli company is making its first production foray in the U.S. by buying a soybean processing plant in northeast Nebraska. The wholly owned U.S. subsidy of Sobar Industries Limited is buying the former Green Plant Farms plant in South Sioux Falls for $16 million, pending regulatory review by the federal government. And Hormel Foods Corporation says that strong sales in its grocery products, such as Hormel Chili, helped its net income rise 11% in the third quarter, despite higher commodity costs. Net income rose to $85.4 million, or 63 cents per share. That's up from $72.2 million, or 57 cents per share last year. Revenue rose 10% to $1.73 billion from $1.57 billion last year. And that's a look at today's business news. You're listening to The Farming World, news and interviews from the land grant in Urbana-Champaign. This is Illinois Public Media Director of Agricultural Programming, Dave Dickey. Joining us today on The Farming World is Steve Freed, Vice President of Research for ADM Investor Services in Chicago, Illinois. Steve has more than a quarter century analyzing grain markets, including Tours and Continental Grain Company and Dean Witter Reynolds. Steve is a graduate in agriculture from Illinois State University. Steve, thanks for being with us today.
Thanks for inviting me.
Why don't you begin with some analysis of how 2010 has played out?
Well, I think we started out, looking for big crops and maybe even some lower prices. And I think that farmers got the crops in on a timely basis, and I think the wheat harvest went well. And we had big crops, at least big yields here. And right in the middle of all this, we had the worst drought in Russian history. And it really turned things around. You have, like one person said the other day, this is not business as usual now. And a lot of question marks about how much actual exports will come out of that region. And then if it's down quite a bit, how much shifts to the United States. And finally, in the last, let's say, 2 weeks, I think that we've seen hotter temperatures than we've seen in a long time, especially at night. And we've seen kind of a back off of normal rainfall, especially east of the Mississippi. So now, when you go out into a cornfield, you're not seeing quite the yield that you had hoped for when you planted the crop. And that's keeping the market at some pretty lofty prices historically and really has a lot of people looking for higher prices down the road.
Well, going forward to spring then, let's look at some of the fundamentals and dig in a little bit deeper off of your opening remarks. When you look at the corn supply, USDA in August put the crop at 13.4 billion bushels on a 165 bushels per acre yield. In our neighborhood, we're hearing about tip back and test weight issues, of course, some flooding issues, nitrogen loss issues. As you look at the USDA figures and also analyze what you're hearing, do you think that 165 is going to stand up as the big number for the season?
Well, and there's obviously a big debate on that. I think that if you're up here in Chicago and would average all the analysts' numbers, they would probably say that the final yield would be probably closer to 163, 163 and a half, which would take about 140 million bushels off the USDA's numbers. The one question mark is that if you go out into a field, you got the tip back, you don't have the kernel depth, you're a little bit concerned about how these kernels are going to fill out if there's no additional moisture, and you also realize that there's a lot of ears out there. Plant population, has been going up, and I think the USDA said nationwide it's the second highest population ever. So You know, that's the debate. But I think right now, if you put a gun to most of the analysts' head, they would say that the final yield will be lower than what the USDA said in August.
That's Steve Fried, Vice President of Research for ADM Investor Services in Chicago, Illinois. For Todd Gleason, this is Dave Dickey. You're listening to The Farming World, news and interviews from the land grant in Urbana-Champaign. We're talking with Steve Fried, Vice President of Research for ADM Investor Services in Chicago, Illinois. Let's look at the demand side then. How do you analyze the livestock sector going into the spring?
Well, animal numbers are down. I think that, you know, cattle prices have been rallying and hogs not too far behind. I think that there'll be some debate on whether or not the economy is going to allow for increase in food demand versus the lower animal numbers. And I think right now, at least in the cattle industry, in that first quarter of 2011, I think they're looking for higher prices just because animal numbers are down and the demand could remain fairly good for beef. And I think that the more important area that for corn demand is exports. I think that the government said 2050 will be our export number versus 1975 last year, and that's millions of bushels. And I think most in the trade are using a number right now closer to 2,300.
So the expectation is that we're going to pick up some more export demand from where?
We think it's mostly going to be from the Black Sea. I think there's like 4 to 5 million tons of feed wheat that comes out of that area every year, and it's been growing every year. And I think the Russians and the Ukrainians have been trying to build their infrastructure to be a net exporter, not only of grains but of meats. And I think that this drought is going to pull that back. And I think that certainly some of the things we're hearing is that the Russians, you know, want to keep a lot of their feed grains domestically to make sure that their livestock industry does survive this. And so I think that kind of limits the amount of grain that comes out. And then I think that you're also seeing probably, when you look at the numbers, every year world corn demand is going up. And whether that's more people outside the United States making a better living and going to a better diet or whatever. And so it's kind of a combination of the lack of Black Sea exports and the fact that every year corn demand goes up.
The third leg of demand is, of course, ethanol production. USDA has it at 4.7 billion bushels of corn. That's an amazing one-third of production, Steve.
Well, I think two things. I think that there's going to be a lot of important announcements from Washington. Number one is whether or not they're going to increase the mandate to E15. Hearing a lot of rumors that for cars that have been built after 2007 that may be increased in September. You also are hearing by the end of the year that they may pull that back to cars made after 2001. The blend credit, you know, there's a lot of talk about it, extending the blend credit, but maybe at a lower value, perhaps 36 cents a gallon. You know, right now it is profitable to be blending ethanol into gasoline, but, you know, you just have to watch the relationship between gas prices and the price of corn.
So when we take supply and add on the demand side, we get ending stocks, according to USDA, at 1.3 billion bushels. Do you think that's going to be too lean, too rich, or about right come spring?
I think a lot of analysts up here, right or wrong, are using a number below a billion bushels for 2010, 2011. And, you know, that suggests a couple of things. Number one, is that you look ahead in 2011, you know, you're going to have to keep prices favorable to farmers to keep corn into the pipeline, and then there'll be an acreage fight in 2011. You know, we're already talking about higher wheat acres, and we need more corn acres, and I don't know if beans can really afford to lose acres. So that's going to be kind of an interesting thing. The other thing that yesterday I was in Champaign County, and They had some yield averages that were below a year ago, but every farmer, or most farmers that you talk to, who had sold, let's say 40, 50% of the new crop corn to date, said they're done selling, and that they are bullish and that kind of thing. So, and I want to send a shout out to Bernie Golden, who was a real informative farmer down there, who had some pretty strong opinions about yields and marketing.
Before we leave the corn and look at the soybeans in particular, I suppose we ought to spend a few seconds talking about old crop carry-in and how much of that corn is still in the pipeline, how much of that corn is not really number two corn, but is three corn or worse, and how does the potential for blending and dealing with that figure into the equation?
You would think that initially that this 2010 crop is going to be better than last year, and you would think that that's a priority of blending that crop, and it'll all be depending upon logistics. The weatherman's talking about a little bit drier than normal harvest. A lot of this corn is drying down pretty fast. It'll probably move sooner than later. Harvest might be earlier this year. So I think that the commercials will be hitting on all cylinders, not only to blend this crop, send it out, maybe record amounts out of the Gulf, Ocno-Dees, and record amount out of the P&W, Ocno-Dees, but also making sure that they get the grain in storage for what is considered to be a good demand year.
Are end users for corn booked up, or are they behind for the winter needs?
I think most end users are a little bit behind. I think that when we looked at the price of corn at the lows back in early July at 343, there were a lot of people who thought, this is going to continue. We're going to have a big yield. A lot of people talking about a 170 U.S. average corn yield. We were going to be able to get corn bought maybe 20, 30 cents lower than that. And then we just took off. And, I think a lot of people have been waiting for kind of a pullback to get that corn bought and get the soybeans bought and wheat's been a very volatile market, so I think in the wheat market the coverage might be a little bit better because they all have memories of 2007 when wheat went a lot higher. But all in all, I think that the end user does not have a lot of coverage.
For soybeans, on the supply side, USDA put the August estimate at 44 bushels to the acre. Stephen, it appears to be a crop with good or great potential, but question marks as well.
Well, I think the August report historically has all been about the height of the plant, and this year's crop, no matter where you drive, looks better than last year, and is a tall crop, and it does have some issues. I think the number one issue is all the talk about disease in Iowa and the impact that's going to have on the Iowa yield, and then the weatherman changes his mind every day on how much rain the Midwest is going to see over the next 2 weeks, and that's what will be critical on, I think, anybody that's going out on any tours or anything like that is finding a higher pod count than a year ago. So, are we going to fill those pods normally and maybe hit the USDA's yield, or is this disease and a little bit lower yields in the Delta because of heat and maybe not best weather ending the season, does that take a little bit of edge off the beans? And then I think beans also have a situation where, some commercials feel it's difficult to trade much below $10. If you back the futures to Brazil farmers and their very high freight rates getting beans from the farm to the interior, we need expansion of acres in South America. And in 2011, with the La Nina year, you have to think that there might be a couple dry spells down in Argentina and southern Brazil. And so it might be difficult to take the bean prices down dramatically, even if we have a good crop here.
If we're looking at sudden death as an issue what percentage of the crop might be reasonable to pencil in at this point?
Oh, I don't think we know. I mean, it just if you talk to people from Iowa, they say the outbreak is the worst they've ever seen. So, I mean, that's something that, you know, yesterday an agronomist says that it's not really a smart thing to try to guess beans before harvest because they can do a lot of changes before you actually get into the field. But, you know, I think it's a very important issue for the Iowa farmer.
Let's look then at the demand side of soybeans. USDA has exports at 1.435 billion bushels. Do you think that number could even get bigger?
You know, I think as an average, analysts are using a number closer to 1,500. We're already seeing record export pace to China. You know, part of that might be due to all the talk about maximizing our export logistics during the November-December timeframe, and them wanting to make sure they have their boats in the lineups. But I also think that you know, it's hard to describe or define or even rationalize, but they continue every year to buy more soybeans than what the market thinks. You know, we'll also have to be kind of watching, you know, the European situation. They may need more vegetable oil. They may need more meal because of this year's crop production and crop quality. And so those things might help the situation. And the crush looks like it might even be a little bit higher than what the USDA said because of, you know, potential increases in meal demand into Europe.
What are the planting potentials in South America for this fall?
You know, right now, you know, you're looking at a little bit higher, maybe acres in Brazil, you know, both for cotton and soybeans, and the corn acres might go down a little bit. But it is the function of the market to try to get Brazil acres up every year to satisfy this growing global protein demand. Argentina, you know, there's still a lot of political issues there, and the export tax, the government's in charge, you know, does the government change? And so that issue is kind of up in the air. The one thing that commercials are saying, though, that it may be difficult to repeat last year's record high yields. Usually they don't have back-to-back weather or record yields. So even the USDA is starting out 8 million tons lower in production in South America for next year versus this year. And the question mark is, you know, can the world afford a normal crop in Brazil and Argentina next year, or do we need another year of record production?
I guess it's time for the bottom line on all this, on all the fundamentals that we've been talking about. What does the price potential look like into the spring for corn and beans?
Well, you know, I think that if you look at a chart, you know, on the waves of up and down and movements and things like that, it looks like, you know, once we get into the harvest, the market, futures market could set back a little bit. But, you know, there's just a lot of talk of, you know, taking out the highs in the spring of 2011 in both corn and soybeans. So farmers are in a good place where a lot of people in the world want their grain, and a lot of it has to do with the Russian drought. And you just have to make sure that you make right marketing decisions. And, you know, there are options that you can buy to protect prices going higher of the inventory that you've already sold. I think it's a good year to be a farmer.
Thanks, Steve, for being with us today.
Thank you very much for the opportunity.
That's Steve Fried, Vice President of Research for ADM Investor Services in Chicago, Illinois. You've been listening to The Farming World. This is Dave Dickey. It's National Chocolate Pecan Pie Day. On this day in agricultural history in 1619, about 20 Africans were brought to Jamestown on a Dutch ship and traded for supplies. Most historians believe that these may be the first Africans to arrive in Virginia. and signaled the beginnings of slave trade. In 1741, Danish explorer Vitus Bering, while on a mission sponsored by Russia, discovered Alaska. In 1866, the newly organized National Labor Union called on Congress to mandate an 8-hour workday. A coalition of skilled and unskilled workers, farmers, and reformers, the National Labor Union was created to pressure Congress to enact labor reforms. Although the NLU failed to persuade Congress to shorten the workday, its efforts heightened public awareness of labor issues and increased public support for labor reform in the 1870s and 1880s. In 1913, stainless steel was cast for the first time in Sheffield, England. Harry Brearley discovered how to make the steel that doesn't rust by accident. And in 1986, the U.S. Census Bureau reported that the U.S. population stood at 240,468,000, and the median age reached an all-time high of 31 and a half years. And that's This Day in Agricultural History. This is Illinois Public Media Director of Agricultural Programming, Dave Dickey. Coming up next, Farm Fresh. Who doesn't like the idea of farm-to-plate with as few steps in between as possible? Certainly not the consumer, but the home buyer is not alone in their desire for direct-from-farm food, as Lisa Brotz discovers in her latest edition of In My Backyard.
The next few weeks are the peakest of the peak season for fresh food in our part of Illinois. I find it glorious this time of year to just keep pulling fresh food out of the garden and making something simple for dinner out of it. It's awesome for me to go to our local farmers markets, too, and choose from the many, many fresh fruits and vegetables that I don't grow and make something simple for dinner. Or complicated. It depends. It's also wonderful to be able to go to a couple of smaller local grocery stores here in town and expect to see Illinois-grown produce there, just in case I run out of something. I'm not the only person. When people see locally grown fruits and vegetables, and meat, cheese, and eggs, too, especially if there's information about where and how it was grown, they're interested in eating them regularly. Just ask the folks in charge at your local small natural foods grocers which department is growing the fastest. I'll bet it's the local produce. There's demand. There is definitely demand. But what about those times when you don't feel like getting dinner going? When you would just rather leave the whole enterprise, especially the dishes, to someone else, but you also want to support local growers while you're taking the night or day or morning off? Getting local food into restaurants is kind of a final food frontier. I'm not even talking about chain restaurants, since their choices in food sourcing aren't necessarily dictated by people who are even in the same country as the restaurant, never mind the same town. Even mom-and-pop restaurants, the bistros and cafes and delis that make our food scene unique, getting local food into these places has never been easy, but it's gotten a lot easier over time. I did some investigating. More and more restaurants all over the United States are starting to source their food, we're talking fresh produce, meat, cheese, and eggs, from local growers. Some places have been doing it for a while. California, for example, has a long list of restaurants who've been sourcing food from local farmers since the 70s. Large cities like New York and Chicago do whatever it takes to bring in food from the surrounding rural areas and farmers markets. Looking at smaller cities, I saw that Middlebury, Vermont has one of the ultimate local food diners, the aptly named Farmer's Diner. Asheville and Durham, North Carolina have vibrant local food cultures that include eateries from fine dining to breakfast joints, focusing on local food. We're starting to see more of it here. I wandered into Black Dog on a recent Saturday afternoon. It was packed. The Urbana restaurant is well known in CU for its take on smoked meats and barbecue. The restaurant has been open for about a year and a half, and while they toyed with locally sourced food in the past, co-owner Mike Cochran has recently been taking steps to add more local food to the menu.
Well, we've gotten a little bit better at it. Been able to make some more contacts, some of them through the farmers market, some of them just finding other farmers and other farmers finding us, and just some through the people that we know. Yeah, so it's improved. It's something that we want to do more of, and there's been a good reception for it, so I think we'll be able to continue doing it.
Mike's responsiveness to customer demand has, in turn, created more demand, which has its ups and downs. On the downside, the farm in Sydney supplying Black Dog with chickens can't keep up, he told me. Fear of not being able to get what they need when they need it is high on the list of restaurateur fears. On the upside, while the sourcing of local ingredients has resulted in a few nominal price hikes on the menu, it hasn't been that big of a deal.
And then for price, it's, you know, I guess a lot of restaurant people figure out things by percentage. So, you know, the investment that you put in and you try to get a percentage, keep your costs at a certain percentage. We have to change that when we do the local food. We do pass along some costs to the consumer, but we try not to raise the price too much. And basically, we just try not to make any less money than we are making on the conventional products. So we don't get the percentage return on our investment, because the investment's significantly more, sometimes up to 4 or 5 times the cost of what we pay right now. But it is worthwhile. The products are much better. I think people enjoy them better, and I think it's I just think it's the right way to go.
One thing I can say for sure, the lines there have been as long as ever, maybe longer. Procuring food from local sources isn't as easy as a farmer walking into a restaurant or a chef walking onto a farm. Distribution, getting the food from the farmer to the chef, is a perpetual problem. The folks at Stewards of the Land, a collective of family farms in or near Fairbury, Illinois, work together to supply restaurants and small grocers in Illinois with a truly awesome variety of locally grown foods. They supply high-end restaurants like Baccaro in Champaign and Frontera Grill in Chicago, as well as some small fry like Dave's Supermarket in Fairbury. And the Stewards have all the business they can handle. Several farms in the Urbana-Champaign area supply a few restaurants with local food in season. One of those farms is Blue Moon Farm, a certified organic produce farm located in rural Urbana. Their farm manager, Lorian Carsey, sends out an email to between 4 and 8 restaurant food purchasers twice a week to let them know what's available, and the farm makes their deliveries accordingly. Lorian thinks the increase in local food in CU restaurants in recent years is encouraging, but there is definitely more to do. We talked the other day after the farmer's market, and she told me, we'd love to sell more of what we grow to the restaurants we're already selling to, and we'd love to sell to more restaurants in general. Local food from local farmers. It's good for the restaurants, it's good for the farms, and it's good for we eaters. Demand at the farmer's market can translate into demand at local restaurant tables, but it'll happen faster if we ask. So belly up to the table and let them know. You might be out for dinner, but you want to keep it local.
Lisa Brott's stories can also be heard on our website, WILLAG.org. Click on the In My Backyard link in the right navigation window. And you can also read her occasional blogs at majorprogression.wordpress.com.